Well, welcome to another Alan Smithy podcast here on Pro Video Coalition. I am here as usual with my good friends, Katie Henson and Michael Comas. Katie, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Michael, you're well?
I'm great. When I get to talk with you two in the morning, that just sets the day off. This is great. I'm doing great.
Well, that's warm. It's afternoon where I am, but that's okay. So I think the first thing we need to talk about is this will be releasing pre-NAB, before NAB 2024. We were just speaking of the fact that the South Hall is back in commission now as they renovate another hall. So perhaps there'll be a little bit more walking than usual. But Katie, you are not going to NAB this year.
That's correct.
We will miss you, and I'm sure you are just heartbroken by this fact.
Look, the best thing about NAB is it's a big old family reunion.
It's a party.
And seeing people coming to Vegas from all over the country and all over the world is really lovely. So I will miss seeing everybody. I also love going around the edges of the halls and seeing all these mom and pop shops that are inventing interesting new things. You know, I find that some of the bigger booths, I mean, we know what they're doing, or they can come to us. But, you know, there's something about discovery and connection that I will miss about NAB this year.
I begrudge the people who say that conferences are dead, they're useless. I still really enjoy going to see the people, to touch those products you can't touch online. And the educational aspect, I'm teaching, I think, 6 classes at Post-Production World. So it's a big, good schedule, kind of getting back to pre-NAB or pre-pandemic levels of classes and stuff with the learning conferences. You know, just in-person teaching, something that you just can't get online. So I'm excited about that. Michael, you'll be there. And we may be doing a sort of a live recording of the Alan Smithy podcast without Miss Katie, even though we will miss her greatly.
I'm tentative, and by the time this podcast goes out, that may change. But going to NAB, I'm right in the bubble right now, and there's just a lot of factors at play. But if I am, yes, I will certainly make time for us to do a in-person recording.
You can't. I'll believe it when I see it. You miss it.
I know. As I've said before, it's my Christmas and New Year's and birthday all wrapped up in one. The only thing I dislike is South Hall lower bathrooms. Everything else is just phenomenal, and I really want to go. There's just some things up in the air.
Which bathrooms do you prefer?
I don't know what you're saying. I'm just going to say, I don't know what you're saying about the bathrooms, because the best thing about technical conferences as a woman is that the bathrooms are clean and there's never a line.
No, the guy's bathroom to South Hall Lower is like someone set off a sprinkler somewhere in the bathroom, and you know, it's just not something that you want to do.
That's too much. That's but too much information. Speaking of NAB, like, I haven't seen a lot of big pre-announcements just yet. I mean, we're recording this right at the end of March. Anything? I mean, other than we know AI will be everywhere. What else can we expect? Have you seen anything coming? Any surprises that you can think of that you want to see? I'm kind of like at a loss.
You're right.
And you guys are at a loss too.
Well, we're right at that cusp, right? It was about maybe a decade or so ago that companies started realizing, if we release what we're doing at NAB, it gets lost in the white noise. So let's start doing it pre-NAB. But then how long before pre-NAB?
Yeah.
And even some of the ones that kind of lead the pack in terms of making announcements like Blackmagic, I got emails from marketing and some PR people at Blackmagic that said, join us and we're going to tell you, but nothing's been released just yet. So I really don't have any updates. However, as you pointed out, everyone and their brother and their sister and their aunts and uncles are going to have something to do with machine learning and AI built in. What I'm really interested to see is how many are localizing that AI and ML instead of just saying, hey, we built a plugin to talk to ChatGPT. Now you have another subscription to pay for.
Because again, CES, everyone thought it was going to be all about AI and ML, and it's not. It wasn't. Because the big companies, that's all they had. You know, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, but everyone else is really, really behind, because they're really reliant on these big companies with their big data sets in order to build things off. So I think the last couple of years at NAB, we've seen AI-ish things like Michael's talking about. But I don't know. I'm a little skeptical that it's going to be the thing this year any more than it was last year or the year before. You know, every year I have my theme of NAB that I sort of announce about a day in. I don't know what it's going to be this year. I hope that it's not the same as last year, because that's just boring, you know, which is sort of AI stuff, you know. No, well, I don't know.
It feels like, you know, when we went to 4K, it was easy to walk around like, here's a 4K display. This camera shoots 4K. Yeah. This software can work with 4K. But I'm not sure how AI can, I guess you can build AI into a Canon camera. I'm sure Resolve could add AI functionality. I mean, it already has it in there to a certain degree. But like, I don't know how a shared storage can utilize AI other than like, here's a software product that can analyze everything.
I can tell you that really easily.
It's not going to be the hardware company's not going to be the one that makes that AI. They would just like buy some AI or lease it and put the software on it, right? Like, I don't know.
I suspect that the theme isn't going to be AI per se. It's going to be 2030 vision. And I think it's going to be all these different things like cloud and ML and whatever, you know, software-driven workflows that are the buzzword being 2030 vision. I think how people are going to excuse the lack of development in the last couple of years. To be honest, my prediction, if I were to put money on it, would be that something along the lines of 2030 vision or something like that is going to be really the theme, I think, this year.
Scott, I think to your point, there's a lot of storage companies, just to take storage companies as an example, who don't have experience with AI and ML, and it makes sense to, I'm going to buy them, which kind of goes into our theme later on in this episode, to buy them and then build them locally for a specific use case and then allow them to run locally. One of the big things that we've grappled with the cloud is that when you start using the cloud, people who are providing a service utilizing the cloud are losing their lunch because they're paying the cloud, right? They don't get to make all that money because, you know, half or even more of it needs to go to the cloud. When we start getting localized models and specifically built models that can be sold and monetized and you don't have to pay a percentage to the cloud, that's where you're going to see these manufacturers go because they can make more money on that.
Are we still a ways away from that, though? Is it feel like so much AI and so much machine learning processing has to be done in the cloud that the ability to do that like locally on a server is still a ways away?
No, because I think what will be done is to use an off-the-shelf LLM, a large language model, or an open source one like Claude, right? I believe Claude is open source. But utilizing these LLMs that understand conversational speech and then just backing it with manuals and content from that particular manufacturer so this AI can do the only things that it is trained to do. So it's got the conversational part plus the small specific purpose-built things that are particular for that storage manufacturer or that camera manufacturer.
I gotcha. Well, we'll see. We're a few weeks away as we record this. Perhaps there'll be something grand and new that we're not even thinking about. I'd love to see a surprise, but who knows what surprise is going to be? Is there any other NAB's kind of news? What else? What are the news we got going on?
Speaking of Vegas, Vegas Pro.
Good.
Wow, segue. You are the queen of segues. That was great.
That was fantastic. So
the question that we've, as professionals, have answered for years now, will I use Vegas? Can I use Vegas in Hollywood? No, you can use Vegas in Hollywood once a year. That's NAB. If you mean, can I use Vegas, the editing software, the company that bought Vegas from Sony, what, 7-8 years ago, Magix, they filed for insolvency.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, it's a business term.
It means you have no money, like you can't pay your employees.
It means you can't pay your debts. You've got no money. Yeah.
Yes.
I really feel, you know, Vegas used to be owned by Sony and then Magix bought it and they've really developed it in the last few years. I've read this and I kind of felt a little bit sad because, you know, they've been trying, God bless them. But I don't know what to say other than that.
Scott, well, in your world, are people using it though?
In my 20 years of editing, I remember going into one place and seeing Vegas in use.
Right. And that's the question. Who's using it?
I think the target was more for individuals, for, you know, creators. I don't think they ever figured they were going to get into the Hollywood market or even like, you know, deep in the corporate market. But you step back and look at, you know, Premiere, Final Cut, Avid. Who has made great inroads into these markets? And that has been Blackmagic with Resolve. So it can be done. But I don't know why Vegas just never, I don't know why it never took off anymore. Michael, do you know?
Well, you know, at the point, DaVinci Resolve, once Blackmagic acquired DaVinci Resolve, DaVinci Resolve wasn't the player that it is today, and it's also free. And so I think there was a confluence of there's a free tool that can do almost everything Vegas can, and it has all this other stuff, and it's free. I think Magic's was rightly marketed, Vegas for Magic's was rightly marketed to wedding videographers, corporate, kind of one person or non-collaborative individuals. And unfortunately, we then came into the era now where folks are using CapCut and things on mobile phones where they may not need a desktop application. So I think it was just a confluence of time and Blackmagic just saying, look, to hell with all of you. We're just going to release something that wipes the floor with you and offer it at an obscene price.
Well, RIP Vegas Pro. Okay, so I've got one. Autodesk announced this week that they are renaming its M&E product again. So a few months ago, I suppose, or a year ago, Shotgun became ShotGrid because they didn't want to have guns in their name, and they acquired Moxian. We were wondering what they were going to do there. They have renamed ShotGrid again, and they've renamed Moxian. I'm not a fan, to be honest, and it's not just because I don't like change, because I do, but Flow Capture is Moxian. Now, okay, I'm okay with renaming Moxian. Hugh, I love you, but it's not great. Flow Capture, but unfortunately, ShotGrid is now called the Flow Tracking App, and clearly no women were involved in that renaming.
Not much more to say there.
Well, there's also I don't know if there wasn't enough research, but a company that I worked at for a hot minute or for a cup of tea was EditShare, and EditShare has a product called Flow. Flow Media Asset Management. And you know, I can see two products having different names if they're at different points of the industry.
They're not. They're media asset management tools. That's the whole. That is exactly what they are. So it's a little unfortunate. Look, there's so many reasons why I'm just wondering what was going on around there. And to be honest, amazing products, and the integration of Moxian into ShotGrid into an entire workflow ecosystem is exactly what they should have done. It's the smartest move, right? It's the Adobification, right, of Autodesk.
There's
smart,
a new term.
Smart, smart. However, really? Flow, you guys? Come on.
And to put kind of a period at the end of that sentence, no pun intended, thought you'd like that. Like Flow from EditShare, there's three different types of flows. There's Flow Story, Airflow, and Flow Automation.
Does EditShare's there's apps for that. Does EditShare's Flow product still exist? Like, did it take off?
Oh yeah, it's an asset management platform. It's very functional. However, in my estimation, it's built by engineers for engineers. Yeah. It's not.
Is it,
it's
if
not
you as, buy into the EditShare ecosystem, like their storage platform and all that, do you just get the Flow product?
It's an add-on.
Part of it?
No, it's an add-on. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, let's flow into the other big piece of news. It seems to me that some little camera company was bought by another camera company. Did I miss that last month?
I don't know anything about that. Michael, have you heard of these camera companies?
Yeah, Sony, right? Sony was purchased by like Wooden Camera or something. It's Red Camera. The Red Camera, which was disruptive in our industry, according to some people not, has been acquired by Nikon for an undisclosed sum. But that includes all the patents, that includes all the hardware, and that includes the livelihood of over 200 people.
Wow. And this was like a, I don't want to say shocking, it's just cameras, but like this came out of the blue. Like Nikon sued Red at one point in the last couple of years, but then we woke up one morning to just this announcement that Nikon had acquired Red. It seemed very, very out of the blue.
It felt like the same kind of play that Panavision did when they bought LightIron. They're an old, not very cool company that bought a cool, innovative company. Now, not to say to be honest, I don't think Red's been particularly innovative in a minute, but they are still known that way. So I think that's the kind of play that we probably saw.
Do you think Nikon learned something through this legal act, this legal tussle that they were in, and were like, you know what? This is like, you know, Nikon RAW is a thing. It's not very well supported in most editing softwares, from what I understand. I mean, I wonder if they, I don't know if they learned something. They were like, hey, you know, instead of sue them, let's buy them.
If you can't beat them, buy them.
Yeah.
And that's done in the industry for many reasons, whether it's shortening the length of time to market. You don't have to hire people internally to build your own better widget. As Katie said, you can always just buy the technology and leapfrog a couple years. And also because there were, you know, lawsuits regarding the potential infringement of Red's IP, this kind of goes away, even though that case was dismissed. If I'm not mistaken, it still paves the way to no longer have those types of issues now that they own them.
I think this is part of a larger trend that we've been seeing in the last 5 to 10 years, really, of consolidation within our industry marketplace. There's just been a lot of this. There's been a lot of mergers and acquisitions. And so I think it's probably less surprising in that sense. But I think it's interesting because we're now seeing the results of a bunch of previous mergers and acquisitions, or acquisitions of smaller companies, more disruptive companies, startups by the bigger corporations. And we're really seeing what that has turned out like. And there are some interesting trends, I think, around that. And there are some reasons to do it. And I thought it might be interesting to kind of look at some of that and then also talk about the disruption term. You know, I think Red being very relevant here, because back in the day, there was a lot of talk about Red being the biggest disruptor of our industry that we'd seen in a very long time. So, but, you know, I think this whole thing around mergers and acquisitions that we're seeing, Michael, is very interesting in terms of what we're seeing and the trends that it's actually giving us as end users.
Well, Red was always like this, you know, scrappy, you know, we're going to do things our way, no rules. We make our own rules, you know, type of startup in our space. And I don't, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but Nikon is kind of a, I won't say stodgy, but they're definitely an established brand, long, you know, grand history. They probably have, I don't know this for a fact, but they probably have a very large and very structured corporate workflow outline, management style. It just feels like this is not what one would have expected out of
it's
Red
exactly
Digital Cinema.
What one would expect. It is exactly what one would expect.
Is it?
It's why Adobe bought Frame.
But Frame wasn't the same kind of attitude sort of thing.
It's not
as
about
Red.
The marketing attitude. It's about the business itself. And the business itself was, you know, was the same. It was scrappy. It was doing something new and different. It was taking risks and actually really giving users what they wanted and developing for the end users, for a market that Adobe wanted. It's the same as Autodesk buying Moxion. It's the same as Panavision buying LightIron. It's there's a reason for these things. Unfortunately, I think, you know, one of the things that I actually called out last time, the innovator's dilemma from Christensen, you know, is one of the things that can happen to these smaller companies when they get absorbed within the larger ones. Unfortunately, you know, the way that I tend to see one of the things that happens is that the main stakeholders of that product move from being the end users to being the shareholders of the company. So it's less about developing that product to make the users happy and more about developing that product to make the shareholders happy. And it's not always the case. I have to say it's not always the case, but it is a risk that you take when you get absorbed by a bigger company.
Well, I think that's kind of goes back to what I was saying. Like, you know, when Red wanted to do something, instead of having, you know, Jim Jannard being the guy who's like, you know what, do it, build that holographic phone. This is going to be awesome.
Right.
Let's do this. You've got this board of directors and you've got this giant corporate structure that these kind of things have to go through. So that's what I don't think they'll be innovating as much as they were, but I mean, perhaps you're right. They've kind of, their innovation window opened, they did what they did, and then it's now behind, you know, they're just one of the norm. They're kind of the norm.
Red was a really big deal. And a lot of people won't necessarily remember this. It was a really long time ago. It was sort of around 2006, 2007 that it kind of really came out. And at the time, there was a commonly held truth in our industry that digital is video and film is film.
Right.
Digital will never be film. And when that Red camera came out, it was the first, it was not technically the first digital camera to try and break onto the film market, but it was the first one that really tried to do it seriously, that really put all its eggs in that basket and said, we are not for video. We are for film. We are for high-end film. We are going to be used on the biggest tent poles, you know, ever, right? They were like, this is the future.
And they were.
But the thing is, at the time, there was a huge backlash against that. And all of the big directors in Hollywood said, that is not true. Digital will never be film. Digital will never replace film. And that is why I called it out at the time as being the biggest disruption of our industry, of our era, because it took a commonly held truth and turned it on its head and proved it wrong and changed the industry permanently from that point forward. And so, you know.
I think what may be interesting as we go down this path is kind of maybe define some parameters, right? Because we have the concept of innovation, which can be manipulated to mean a lot of things. We have the concept of disruptive, which can be a really egotistical business title, but it can also mean something completely different. Yeah. So I can, or Katie, if you want to, do you want to kind of define where those terms come from and why they're important to know?
I mean, largely they come from Clayton Christensen. He was the first to define disruption and coin that term. And I think he had a particular definition of that, which, you know, most people subscribe to. I personally don't necessarily subscribe to it. But I know, Michael, you've often used that as a way to characterize whether something is truly a disruptive innovation. Is that right?
Right. And, you know, things change. And I believe the first edition came out in what, mid 90s, I think. So obviously there wasn't the explosion of technology in the same way in the 80s and 90s as there was now, right? There wasn't cloud, there wasn't AI, everything was still on-prem. But Clayton kind of defines disruptive innovation is one of three things. And like Katie, I don't agree with all of these 100%. I'm not a literalist, but they boil down to, is the new product that's created, is it inferior? Is it inferior to all the other products that have been created to do that same job prior? Because remember, it has to do something new. Is it combinatorial? Combinatorial, meaning does it combine different technologies and put them together, right? Because we're at this point in history where you rarely develop something that's never been thought of, has all new parts that have never been created. We're largely taking and building an erector set off things. So is it combinatorial? Next, is it bottoms up? And this is where the red angle kind of comes into play, is a disruptive innovation bottoms up, meaning is it marketed towards consumers or entry level folks, and then it worked its way up to be what they call up market. And so those three things is how Clayton defines something as being disruptive. And if they don't adhere to those strict three qualifications, then it becomes what he calls sustained innovation, which is more riffing on existing technology and improving it incrementally and serving your same clients.
Yeah, look, I mean, a lot of people cite things like Uber as disruptive, Airbnb, because, you know, for various reasons, you know, again, from my definition, they take a commonly held truth. Nobody's going to rent out their spare room to a stranger and make it completely wrong and therefore change the future of that belief forever, permanently. You know, look, back in the day, back at the time, there was back in 2017, I believe, you know, there was a bit of back and forth around that. I highly recommend going back to Pliny's blog on this, where he said, you know, red was not disruptive, film was not being disrupted yet. You know, I countered with red was totally disruptive because it did that thing, right? Where everyone said it's not possible, and suddenly we don't even remember a time when that. I think a lot of people are going to hear me say that people were honestly, like, the biggest names in the industry were saying that the red camera will never be a thing. Digital will never be a thing. I mean, people took that very seriously. And, you know, of course, now we're like, well, most films are shot digitally now, even if they're processed on film. Like, it's just completely ridiculous to us now. So I think there's a lot to be said around the red being disruptive. I think it'd be interesting to look at what has been disruptive since then, and where are we between then and now? Because I think there has been a lot of more things that have been claimed to be disruptive in our business and have actually been disruptive in our business since. What do you think, Michael? You got any thoughts there, or Scott?
Well, I've got one very similar. You know, when you talk about what RED did for the camera market, this is a tangent, but very similar to what Tesla has done for the automotive market. There were electric cars before Tesla, but Tesla came along, took an idea, perfected it in such a way that it changed an industry.
It did. They countered the idea that electric cars will never be cool.
Yep. But in the camera space, the 5D was a disruptor in the way that in RED was. It was a digital disruptor at the very low end of the market. Unlike RED, which was a digital disruptor at the high end of the market, I don't think we would have seen some digital move forward in the lower end space if the 5D hadn't come along shooting video, you know, with the look that it did. Like that was a total game changer. I could tell. I worked at a post house where the main thing they did was processed and transferred film. And the discussions we had around RED and then the 5D was just, you know, these, like you said, these people are like just denounced it, you know, at every corner that these things will never catch on. And they're a fad,
That's not a disruption. That's incremental. The disruptor was RED. The disruptor was what opened up that industry. That opened up that people's minds to the fact that you could do this stuff digitally. And we were already doing video digitally. That was the idea, was that video could be digital, but film could never be digital. And the 5D was incremental in that it meant that digital capture for video could look nicer. It could look more filmic, but it didn't.
But putting it at that price point that anybody could get it was part of, I think, I mean, in my market especially,
that was
disruptive.
Yeah, RED did that.
RED did that. The RED camera was much less expensive than other film counterparts. So it did.
It was, but you didn't see markets outside of Hollywood being able to go out and buy a RED camera. You saw lower end markets that were buying 5Ds left and right and producing gorgeous stuff that never would have been able to do it without a 5D.
I absolutely.
Or something at that lower end market. Yeah, maybe disruptor's not the. I'll give you a disruptor. Wait a minute. I've got one. FireWire. That was a disruptor back in the day. It was.
Sustained. That sustained because where'd you have prior? You had USB. This was faster and better. It wasn't inferior, right? It was a whole new technology, right? So that's not combinational, right?
And it didn't take a commonly held belief and turn it on its head forever.
I don't know. I think the stuff that just FireWire alone allowed to happen, and again, to go back to the lower end part of the market
That's just what technology is. That's just innovation. That's the definition of innovation, of moving technology forward. That is not disruption. Disruption is when you truly fuck something up.
All right, I'm 0 for 2 now. So let me have one. Who's got the next?
Next time I make a mistake on an edit or something, I'm just going to say I apologize for my disruption.
That's called disruption, because it really has to absolutely disrupt. It absolutely has to be controversial. It has to have people hate it.
People hated the 5D. I can tell you that.
Why don't we look at things that have happened since the advent of HD, all right? Okay. Let's look at things like cloud. Would you consider the cloud to be a disruptive technology or a sustained or a disruptive innovation innovation?
All right. I think that.
So first, hang on, let's go around. Let's do roundtable, right? So the first qualifier according to Clayton is it inferior?
Yes.
Scott?
Is the cloud inferior to
local?
I plead the fifth.
I would say it is inferior because you could buy something that would work on premises and then try to do the same thing in the cloud at the beginning, and you couldn't.
Is it inferior? You kind of have to quantify that with a little bit more. Like, it is inferior in some ways, but superior in many other ways.
That's not the qualification. Is it better? Well, the first qualification, is it better or worse in terms of feature set? All right.
When it comes out. Yeah, when it comes out. Right.
Second, is it combinatorial?
Yes.
Does it use various pieces that the cloud architect put together to make this cloud thing?
Correct. Yes.
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Is it bottoms up?
Yes.
I don't even know what that means.
Yes.
Okay. Meaning, does it tailor to consumers, prosumers, down market? All apologies to down market folks.
Oh, yeah.
It appeals to that.
Work. It allows them to have collaboration with that infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that's what's cool about the cloud.
And also,
it's a disruptor.
You can rent it instead of buying it. Now, obviously, if we look at how long you rent it, it's going to cost more than you buy it. Sure, but for people just starting to use it, it is infinitely less expensive than an on-prem solution that does the same thing.
And then let's take my definition. Let's look at my definition. Does it take commonly held belief and turn it on its head?
Oh,
yes. I can say that it does in many cases. And one of those things that I often cite is that it enabled a disruption for sure. During the pandemic, the disruption happened that high-end, real filmmaking could be done remotely. It was considered that that was not possible. You cannot color grade remotely. You cannot do a DI. You cannot do high-end work remotely. I battled that for years. Right, as a commonly held truth. And I said, that is going to change. I don't know what's going to be the catalyst that makes it change, but it's going to change. That commonly held belief is going to change. And then the pandemic came around and there wasn't a choice. If you wanted to keep working, you had to do it remotely. And you know how we did that? Because we had the cloud.
But the cloud, just saying the cloud is a disruptor, that is a bit more of an abstract than it is a specific product like the Red camera. So I call a little bit of a cheat on that, Michael. The cloud was a disruptor, but...
Oh, I would say AWS was the disruptor.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, right, because that enabled so many different cloud workflows to build on one specific product.
Right, and for our industry, it was the one that tailored it specifically for M&E. So as a company, Amazon chased M&E. Amazon is the backbone of Netflix. Which is so ironic if you think about it. But Amazon is the backbone of Netflix. Amazon enabled Netflix. I mean,
thank you, Amazon, for bringing us Tiger King.
Right.
Even a pandemic. What's like so AWS, and then what's an equivalent like Azure? Is that
GCP, but you're.
But they're not designed for M&E.
There's a chasm there.
Yeah, they're not designed for M&E.
But AWS was the first one where, like, I don't want to say just anybody, but if you knew what you were doing, you could then buy a piece of that cloud and build your product on it, right? Was that the first?
No, Google was.
But Google, theirs hasn't taken off quite like AWS, though.
You had Gmail, Drive, and everything before you had AWS.
Right. But you couldn't, if you had a product idea, you couldn't just buy a piece of Google's cloud server and build your product on that, could you?
Yeah. Not in M&E.
They had APIs.
Yeah. But for sure.
But it seems to have not taken off the way AWS is ubiquitous.
You're only looking through the lens of our industry.
You know, there's a great video out there, which is like, I think it was like all 500 AWS services in 30 minutes or something like that. There is an insane amount of services that AWS has that even AWS engineers can't name them all. And that's because there was this gold rush to build platforms on top of the services that AWS had to enable every single vertical out there to use AWS.
Top 50 AWS services explained in 10 minutes.
There you go. Put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I'm bookmarked. I want to watch this.
I think what may be good is to move on to AI and ML to keep things relevant.
There you go.
Is it
sustaining or disruptive? Let's do it.
Is it sustaining or is it disruptive? And let's go around. Let's do the round table again. And I'll start with Scott. So I'll start with you. Is AI and ML a sustaining innovation or is it a disruptive innovation?
Give us each qualification.
Okay. Is AI and ML inferior to current technology and tools?
No.
It's not inferior.
Yes. When it started, absolutely.
Yes, I'd agree. It's inferior.
Well, when it started, maybe, but
that's the
now
point.
That it's matured.
That's the point. When it first became public, when it first came out in public, was ChatGPT shitty? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, okay. you can't take a product and then look after 5 years and say, well, at the five-year mark,
now
innovates. doesn't work like that. No. Okay.
Should you say that you're saying ML and AI? Should we specifically say like ChatGPT? Because
I think we should say generative. We should say generative AI.
Okay. That,
ChatGPT brought AI into the mainstream, whereas like Midjourney brought generative AI into the mainstream.
No, they're both generative. ChatGPT is generative.
Right, but one is, but it's text-based, whereas Midjourney is image-based.
It doesn't matter. I mean? Like, they're both the same thing.
Right, but in the public consciousness, they're very different in what they do. Like if you were to talk to random Yahoo on the street, they wouldn't think of those two as being necessarily the same thing, even though their underlying technology conceptually is the same.
Would you think that they would call them both AI?
I think they probably will look more at what the result of it is.
They would call them both AI. I think if we were to be more pedantic, which we are, we would call them both generative AI.
Let's go over so that's the inferior portion. The next one, is it combinatorial? Does generative AI combine multiple disparate technologies to create a new product?
Yes.
Okay. Katie?
No.
This is one that I wish you could look at the history of our shared Google Doc and just how many times I wrote something in backspace and wrote something in backspace, because you could argue that once the concept of a transformer model came about around 2017, that enabled the launch of generative AI, modern generative AI and LLMs. But you could also say, well, there's the transformer portion of it. There's also the fact that now in 2021, 22, 23, 24, we have massive data sets, which we train these models on. And you could also say, well, you know what? 5 years ago, we didn't have the GPU horsepower in the cloud to actually train these in any decent amount of time, but now we do. So in that respect, it's combinatorial.
You could say anything is combinatorial because you build a product out of existing parts.
Yes.
You build a car out of existing parts. So just because a Tesla has wheels doesn't mean that it's not, come on.
I get it. I do not think in the purest sense of the word that it is combinatorial. I firmly believe that the modern transformer model was the genesis of where we are today.
Okay. And does it take an existing known truth?
Oh, we didn't do bottoms up.
Oh, sorry. We didn't do bottoms up. Bottoms up. Absolutely. Okay. 100%. Bottoms up. Yes.
Yes, I would agree as well, because it allowed...
I want to say no just to contradict y'all.
Oh, come on.
It was free. Don't get any more bottom up than that.
It's true. Very true.
All right. Okay, so does it take a commonly held truth and make people go, you know what? How could people have ever thought that was true? What is the commonly held truth that it negates?
That a computer cannot comprehend.
Oh,
now, but the word comprehend...
because again, I would argue that
it doesn't. It doesn't. So what commonly held belief is it that you can't talk to a computer?
Well, no, go back to the Yahoo on the street I mentioned. Yeah. They don't necessarily understand the whole predictive world of AI, where it's looking at these models and like, I'm just predicting the next thing. If you type something into ChatGPT and you have this conversation with a lot of folks, will think that, oh, that's really thinking.
Yeah,
that's
but we've had chatbots before. Like,
I'm telling you, most people don't know this.
That computers can't think. Okay.
So what would be the commonly held belief?
I think it's how it's going to disrupt specific industries or how it's going to disrupt specific things. I think that's where we need to go with this, because I think it's so big and it's so everywhere. I think that if you were going to look at that, you would look at what commonly held belief that might there be within our industry, within others, that it turns on its head. I think in the medical industry, in the science, I think there's something to be said there. I think it can be quite, I don't know enough to really be more specific on that, but I think in terms of discovery of, you know, real breakthroughs, I think the commonly held belief is that it takes years. I think that has now been turned on its head because of the power of computing and generative AI to be able to go through that amount of data and find things like new protein structures, new vaccines, new cures for things. I think that is disruptive. I think it is that AIML is disruptive to healthcare, for example. But let's be more, you know, on topic here, let's talk about whether we think it's disruptive or could be disruptive to our industry. Because let's talk about this. This is what everyone's saying. How about the commonly held belief that, you know, it takes a person to do a thing?
And I think we could even get into even sub verticals, right? Mm-hmm. It used to be, oh man, something is stuck in my shot. Now I have to roto it. That was kind of the held belief. You had to have an artist or someone go frame by frame and do that manually.
Now, I don't know. We haven't done that for some a while. Cases, no, it hasn't been like that for a while. I don't know. I this is why I truly think that people are overblowing and overhyping how disruptive AIML is going to be to our industry. I think that there are parts that will be disrupted. I think localization, mm-hmm. I think deliverables, 100%. Localization being a big one. I think that what AIML can deliver is going to disrupt certain parts of our industry. Absolutely. Like I said, localization being a huge one, right? You can't just have a film and suddenly have it in another language. Like there is a process that has to be done, which is now no longer true. And I think in 5 years time, people will forget that people ever believed what we believe now. But I don't think it is disruptive necessarily for post-production. I don't think it is disruptive for production. I think it is disruptive for visual effects in some areas. I think beyond that, there's a lot of hype out there that talks about how disruptive AIML is going to be to our industry. I honestly think that for the most part, it's going to be incremental and sustaining innovation.
It sounds like a lot of this talk in our industry, it's going to do wonders for technical. It's going to make technical faster, easier. It's a very technical thing that it can disrupt, but mm-hmm. not a creative thing.
Correct.
Because and that goes back to
the human being. This is the roadshow I've been on for years.
Yeah.
That computers cannot, by their very definition, ever be creative. And so if you are talking about a creative industry, it will not disrupt that. I believe that. I will stick by it. It is a commonly held truth. So let's see if it gets disrupted. But, you know, I think by their very definition, computers are predictive machines. Computers do what they're told. There are so many things about you define creativity, you define art, and that a computer on its own without a human driver cannot create art, cannot be creative by the very definition of what a computer is. So, I mean, that's a whole other conversation for another day. But, you know, I don't think that at the scale that people predict necessarily, there is a disruption for the whole of our industry, but I think there are definitely parts where it'll be disruptive. What do you think, Michael? I've been talking too much.
Oh, no, not at all. We love being pedantic,
yeah.
Which means kind of drawing lines in the sand and saying this is this and this is that. And when it comes to the tools that can be used in various parts of production and post-production, it becomes a real case-by-case basis. You could argue, like you just said, that some of the AI is going to be incremental, right? Roto was manual and then it had some ML attached to it. Now it can be done in a little bit more automated fashion. Okay, that's incremental. But you could also look at it from the fact of, yeah, it always required human interaction and now maybe it doesn't as much. It's unfortunately a fence we have to be on. I am still going to say AI and ML is disruptive, even if it doesn't match all the criteria of Clayton that Clayton laid down. And I guess that's the bet I've made. And I'm going to sleep in it.
Fair.
You know, you look at some of these. You talk about having a human behind the computer, and you look at some of these. You know, these still images that Midjourney and Stable Diffusion was producing. You start looking at the stuff that Sora we talked about in our last episode. These people are behind the keyboard making these prompts,
yeah.
And still so much of what is coming out of it is god awful.
Yeah, but that's just the nature of the technology. It's not there yet. But there is a lot all of these things to go well. In order for these things to produce anything that is truly great, it does actually require a lot of human input. It is actually very hard to do. It doesn't do it out of the box. I think a lot of people believe that it's a push one button and you get a masterpiece.
Oh, yeah.
It is a very complex workflow process. It can take weeks. It takes a lot of, you know, LoRAs. LoRAs are the new LUTs, I will say, which are the little tiny sort of mini AIs that people train to get a specific look that they like, that is of their thing. It's the new LUT. It's, you know, I think that there is, you know, again, there's always going to be a person driving.
What I've heard from many creatives is when we get to the point when a director can say, I want you to change the look on that person's face from happy to sad and put a coffee cup in their hand. And I can do it with one prompt and it only changes that. That's the inflection point. That's where it's time to maybe find another job. But as Katie just pointed out, you can't do that. No. It would take weeks of prompting and you still wouldn't be able to get it exactly the way you wanted. It's still hit and miss.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it just gives you what it wants to give you. It's random. And it's not controllable. And I think that's hard for creatives. You can't really, you can't get what you want out of it. You get what's random out of it and you pick one you like, but that's not really creating. That is curating. And that's not really what we do here.
It's funny you mentioned that, Katie. I was watching a video this morning. Kelsey, do you know Kelsey, Premiere Gal? Mm-hmm. She has great tutorials on Premiere, and she was talking about a plugin with, I think it was Opus and Premiere. And part of her criteria is AI generated 9 of these. How many are usable? Mm-hmm. And without fail, it was half or less than half of what was generated or even passable for social media, let alone something more long form. And I just thought that was kind of like, what is that? Shout it louder for the folks in the back. You're bearing the lead. That was the true proof.
And I know that a lot of people are saying that over time it's going to get better. And that's absolutely true. One thing that was pointed out to me recently, and again, Cory Doctorow wrote a really good piece on this, talking about how the issue is that because a lot of these large language models, again, these models are all trained by basically 3 companies, right? So it's this monopoly here. And once they've used up the whole internet, what happens is people start using this thing as well to generate more content on the internet. And then it starts training on AI-generated content. Now, what we're finding is that when an AI trains on AI-generated content, it gets kind of poisoned. It's sort of an incestuous thing that actually creates not good output. So it's starting, there seems to be diminishing returns at a point. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that is solved and what happens there.
That sounds like the generative AI version of Skynet.
Speaking of generative AI, I'm going to move on to one cool thing because I have 2, right? And one of them is actually relevant to this. GDC happened this week, and I highly recommend watching Jensen Huang's keynote from
GDC is?
Michael?
Oh, Game Developers Conference.
Thank you. I wasn't a gamer, so I didn't know. I didn't get that acronym when you when you said it the first time.
So Jensen Huang is...
Scott, you can't be in our industry and not know technical acronyms. Come on, Scott.
It's not technical. Don't worry.
I just don't game.
It's not for everyone. Look, Jensen Huang is the CEO of NVIDIA. He really is the biggest rock star in tech right now. Watching his keynote, even like he actually
kind of the jacket is what makes him a rock star. Let's be straight on that.
You look at the stadium of people; it looks like a rock conference. Like people are really into it. Like everyone's got their phones up in the crowd, like filming this guy. Like he really is incredible. And his keynote was really fascinating because what it did for me, I mean, it talked a lot of tech, it talked a lot of really, you know, really nerdy stuff. But how it actually starts with, here are all the things we're doing with AI. And it, you know, a lot of people ask me, how do you keep relevant in technology? It's that I get out of my own sandbox and I go see what people are doing in other areas and what in other industries. And I think it's great to just get a little bit of perspective when he talks about, here's all the stuff that NVIDIA is doing with AI right now. And it's stuff you don't even imagine. It's stuff you wouldn't even think of. Yeah. And it's a really great way to actually start getting outside of your own little world and really seeing what else there is. And I will also plug a second one cool thing, because I have 2 cool things today, because that was my half, actually. The other one is a website called theresanaiforthat.com. I think, Scott, you're going to find this one quite useful. You ask us a lot, like, is there an AI that can do this thing for me? It's like, here's a website. It's called theresanaiforthat.com. You search for the thing you want an AI to do, it gives this you kind of everything awesome that's out there. It's crowdsourced. It's kind of useful.
Now, Katie, I've seen an explosion of index sites that are kind of like a cross reference or a browser. Do you feel that this one is better than a lot of the other ones out there?
No, I think it's accessible though. I think it's simple, accessible, crowdsourced. There's a lot of other stuff that you can go to from there if you want to dive deeper into the community around that thing. That's what I like about it. It's the one that I point people to because it's just, It's nothing. It's not for tech people. It's for people who aren't tech, who like, I just want a thing that can write me some good SEO. It's not for the people who actually want to dive deep into AI. It's for the people that just want a helper to automate something for them.
It looks like a lot of fun. I'll do my next, Michael. I want to wrap with yours. I will say this about NVIDIA. Interesting you mentioned them. They feel like they, when all this AI thing is all said and done and shakes out, NVIDIA may be like at the top of the food chain with the stuff that they're doing, totally. The money they're making. Like, you know, they are, it's just really, it's really amazing to look at them and how they've grown in this AI MML space. All right. So my one cool thing, it's not as general. It's very specific. And again, go back. It's a specific editing thing, but this is the world that I live in. It's a plugin, an extension for Premiere Pro, and it's called iXML Renamer. And I like it because it was just, you know, a person. I think he was an editor who had some coding skills, who realized that when people record WAV files on set, a poly WAV file, they can name each channel with like the mic. You know, say you got 9 people wearing lav mics, give the lav mic the person's name. So when you go to edit, this has not always been easily accessible. It has been in Premiere. I'm sorry, it has been in Final Cut for years. Resolve added it. Avid's finally added a way to read this easily within Avid. In Premiere, it has always been you had to dig deep in the metadata panel, and then you could just see it, this data in the panel. But the data existed. So what this guy did was he wrote an extension that will then grab that metadata from out of the WAV file and then assign it to the individual channels in the time. So you can see when you put the WAV file in the timeline, each channel, each track, the channel is in a track, but it's on the clip itself, has the name of what the channel is that was assigned to it when it was recorded. You can do that on the WAV file. You can put it when you make a multicam. You can have it add that metadata into the multicam audio channels. And it is so freaking useful, reality show editors, when you've got these giant recordings where so many people are mic'd up, you can now see exactly what the mic name is, the channel name is, on the actual WAV file itself or the mic
cool.
itself.
That's really cool.
Editingprep.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. And it's pay what you want. Like I would please pay this guy something, even if it's just a couple of bucks. But it's not like a $50 thing. It's like a pay what you want. So simple, so incredibly useful. And finally, we can get, you know, Adobe needs to build this in internally. But until then, iXML Renamer is it.
Nice.
I'll wrap us out with a website called sievedata.com, if I'm pronouncing it correct, S-I-E-V-E data.com.
Siv?
Siv. Siv, okay.
You don't do any baking, clearly.
No, I'm relegated to taking out the trash. That's about it. But Siv Data is a website that allows you to use different AI tools, AI ML tools, and stack them to create a workflow. So that becomes your AI ML tools become building blocks. And there's examples that can either use publicly available AI ML models or say, look, in this blocks we've built, this uses OpenAI. So you have to have an OpenAI key. But it also uses, as I said, free models. And they have different use cases. If you just hit their webpage, there's one that's auto crop, which does automatic cropping of a video. There's one that does analyze transcripts. One will generate AI sound effects. One that I love a lot is lip sync, which you can feed it any video and it will change the way the lips move to reflect what's being said. So if you
want to- Because most of them aren't right now.
Right. And granted, we're still in the infancy, right? Because AI is still disruptive, right? So it's going to get better. But this allows you to use AI in sequence to modify your media or text or whatever you want to throw at it. And some of them are free and some of them you pay for. But I recommend you go there, check it out. It does help if you have a little bit of a programming background. But if not, you can use any of the dozens of pre-built models and just pay if you need to or just use them free.
So pretty much the same as mine, but mine is for the people that don't have any kind of technical background, and yours is the one for people who want to take it up a notch.
See what you get when you listen to our One Cool Things. You get cheap for the non-techies and expensive for the techies, even though it's not. I don't know how expensive
it is. It's not.
Those are great. Those are okay. We can spend some time on those two things. So that's cool. Thank you all for those. I bookmarked both of those. They look like a lot of fun, and hopefully everybody enjoys the one cool things that we try to go through every month. And when we adjourn again, or we meet again, we're about to adjourn. We'll post NAB, and I'm sure we'll have a bit of an NAB wrap up. And if you guys aren't there, you can watch from afar, and we shall see what amazing things happen when we connect again.
And Michael, sign Katie, up for thanks. Scott's classes. Sign up for Scott's classes at NAB.
That's right. Come visit Post Production World. If people don't attend these things, they don't happen. So let's, come spend some money. See y'all on the backside of NAB.